I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Why is it that we typically separate planning for highways, transit, and trains in the U.S.? Worse, why do we plan for transportation and land use as if they don't relate to one another? Those are subjects we'll explore today with Shelley Porticia, President and CEO of Reconnecting America. She's working to integrate transportation systems and the communities they serve. We'll also talk with Dr. Scott Phillips about some disturbing disparities he's found in the way we apply capital punishment to blacks and whites in America. And Dr. John Shearer of the Enterprise Center will tell us about a novel system Chattanooga has adopted to keep community organizations there working together. That's today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Shelley Porticia is the president and CEO of Reconnecting America, a national nonprofit organization working to integrate transportation systems and the communities they serve. Shelley formerly was the executive director of the Congress for the New Urbanism, where she guided its growth into a national coalition with a prominent voice in national debates on urban revitalization, growth policy, and sprawl. She has authored several books, including The New Transit Town, Best Practices in Transit-Oriented Development, Charter of the New Urbanism, and The Next American Metropolis with Peter Calthorpe. Shelley, we've typically thought of transportation in separate silos. Highways are treated separately from transit, which is treated separately from trains. Does that make sense?
Well, I think that Americans want more transportation choices, and we shouldn't be predetermining what we spend our money on. We ought to be talking to communities about what their problems are in terms of getting around their community and how they'd like their quality of life to improve, and then determine what the right solution is rather than saying it's got to be highways or transit or bikes.
Are people in the best position to know what they want in terms of transportation?
Well, all of our work is showing that people want more transit, more opportunities to walk and bike, and the current system doesn't allow that to happen. We're really slanted more toward building more highways as the only solution that's really easy to do.
How is it that people with no experience with transit want more transit?
Well, a lot of them travel all over the country. And when they go to a new city or go to European cities, they see that there's this lifestyle that comes alive when you can walk to take a tram car or a streetcar or a light rail line, get to their next destination easily, comfortably, in a great environment. And so they see that as a benefit to their communities. They bring these ideas back, and it becomes part of a local conversation.
Does anybody lobby for the best transportation system, whatever mode that might be? Do we have any agnostics in transportation?
Well, because of the way that our government funds transportation, all of the lobbyists are really about either highways or transit or bikes. One of the things that we're working on at Reconnecting America is to bring together these groups to have a conversation about, let's find the right solutions, not just sit in our different silos and ask for more money for our interest groups.
Is there interest in doing that?
I think there's a lot of interest, and it's in part because there are a whole bunch of new players who want to see some change. People from the aging community, because the fastest growing group of people in America are older people. We're seeing business interests being concerned about their employees getting to work on time and reliably, and they want to see some transportation options. We're seeing the development community being very interested in the rebound of cities and the neighborhoods that are growing up around transit, in part because these neighborhoods are holding their value more than places that are out at the periphery of the region where you need to drive for every single trip. We're seeing the health community be interested because they're seeing the health benefits of being able to walk as part of your daily routine. So all of a sudden, there's this whole group of people who have an interest in transportation that we never had before. And this is causing the conversation to really change.
What about the traditional voices on transportation, like highway builders? Are they entering this conversation willingly?
Well, I think they're being dragged into it rather than willingly entering it. But there is a real crisis in the United States with funding highways right now. The Federal Highway Trust Fund is about to go bankrupt. This is the fund that pays for all of the highways. And in order for them to gain support for money continuing to flow toward building any kinds of roads, they're going to need to build alliances. And so that's part of the reason why they're beginning to come to the table and talk about how we need a new vision for the way that we make decisions about transportation investments.
We also have not always linked land use and transportation. How did that happen? Siloed and segregated planners?
Well, we became specialists. There were the transportation people whose job it was to solve for moving cars as easily and quickly as possible. And there were the folks, the local planners, whose job it was to look at zoning and approve development projects. And they often never had an impetus for working together. And this has caused so many problems in American cities where congestion is really mounting up. We're building in patterns where every single trip has to be made by car, in part because of the configuration of the streets and the configuration of land uses. So there's a real growing consensus that we need to link these two fields together. That's one reason why this movement is beginning to take off.
Give me the quick definition, Shelley, of transit-oriented development.
Well, I think of it mainly as great neighborhoods where it's easy to walk, where it's convenient to bike. And if you want to leave your neighborhood, you've got a great transit option. And it connects to downtown, it connects to universities, it connects to cultural institutions in the community. It gives you the option of using other than the car to get around. We like to see wonderful shops along every street. We like to see all kinds of different housing in these neighborhoods. We want to see places that are job centers connected to transit. But mostly I think of great, wonderful places that we want to be that are connected to transit.
You've just released a new publication titled Why Transit-Oriented Development and Why Now. Let's take them one at a time. Why Transit-Oriented Development?
Well, I think why transit-oriented development is because there just is a real need to begin to confront the way that we're building in America. We need to confront the carbon challenge of putting so much pollution in our air because we're driving so much and because people are looking for more ways of living, more housing opportunities, more different types of neighborhoods, and all of the places that we're working around the country, people are saying they'd like more transportation options beyond simply being chained to their car full time.
You say they want different kinds of neighborhoods. Why now?
Well, for 50 years, we've been building in a pattern where the predominant housing type has been the single-family home on a large lot. And so if you're going out into the marketplace, that is the main option that you have out there. But what we're seeing as the demographics of America are really changing, we're seeing an aging society, we're seeing younger people waiting longer to form families, we're seeing an increased diversity in our communities. There is a real interest in smaller housing types where you don't have to take care of the lawn or the big house, and you want to be part of a neighborhood and the cultural activities in your community. So there's a growing interest in these more urban neighborhoods, shall we say, where all of this can take place, and there's less of an emphasis on the needs that just families have in a large single-family house along a cul-de-sac at the edge of a region.
Streetcars, you write, are the hot new technology. What is a streetcar?
Well, we used to have streetcars in almost every city in America, and they went up most of the large boulevards of our communities. They often became the kind of hub of neighborhood retail streets where housing was just a block or two away. And we're seeing an interest. There's a group of about 70 cities around the country that are exploring the idea of bringing streetcars back. Some of them are actually interested in bringing those historic streetcars back, the ones that we used to have in our community. And I'm from the Bay Area in San Francisco. Market Street has a whole set of historic, older streetcars that run along the street and drop you off every couple of blocks. In other places, we're looking at more kind of European-style trams that connect a downtown to the surrounding neighborhoods or link up new areas that are growing. And streetcars are really seen as a very low-cost, easy, and convenient way of bringing transit to a community and linking it up with urban revival.
Historic streetcars are easy to understand in a city like San Francisco, which already has streetcars. But why in the world would you introduce streetcars into a city today when they're hard to board? What sense does that make?
Well, I think most of the places that are putting kind of historic streetcars into communities are building them in places where they used to have a streetcar. Where we're putting in transit into new neighborhoods, most places are looking at the kind of European-style modern streetcars. And that's in part because they do allow you to walk right on from the sidewalk. There's no step up. They allow you to buy your ticket before you get on to the tram. And they're much more conducive to kind of a fast-paced urban lifestyle.
They feel more like toy transit to me.
Well, I think that one reason that some places are doing it is that, you know, it's very low cost. Often they have the rails in the street. They just need to fix them up and clean them. They might even have a supply of the cars around, or there's a whole actual secondary market out there where you can buy streetcars on eBay and fix them up. So it's a cheap way of providing transit. It's probably not the most expeditious way of providing transit that's really fast and easy in a community.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Shelley Porticia. She is president and CEO of Reconnecting America, a national nonprofit organization working to integrate transportation systems and the communities they serve. Many people believe that fixed guideway transit is a bad idea because it locks into place the transit route. But don't highways do the same thing?
Well, that's exactly right. Well, you know, most of the pattern of our regions is organized around the highways. And if you go to every region in the country, you see the off-ramps and all the same hotels, motels, fast food. That's a pattern of development that's organized around highways. One of the reasons that I think that fixed guideway transit should be looked at more frequently is that we see that it can really be an organizing element for development, development-oriented transit. And the development community is less likely to invest along a bus route that could move and change and go in a different route than a route that they know is going to be there throughout the life of their investment.
Fixed bus lines would give you the same kind of security for development purposes, wouldn't they?
Well, there is an interest, growing interest, in what we call bus rapid transit. And in many ways, it acts and functions like a tram or a light rail line because they build the curbs out to the street. They put in the ticket boxes so you can buy your ticket before you get on. The bus rides in its own lane, and it functions very efficiently. It's not getting stuck in traffic with a bunch of cars.
How do you weigh the cost of a streetcar system against the cost of roads with cars or buses?
Well, The reason why I think that the cost of streetcars is so low is in part because the per mile cost of building a streetcar is much less than, say, a subway system where you have to build a tunnel, or a light rail system, which requires a lot more foundation. Streetcars are, in general, about a third of the cost of those other transit options, if not less than that. In terms of capacity, they create a tremendous amount of capacity for people to move along a particular corridor, much more than, say, a road lane does, probably four or five times the amount of capacity as a road with cars in it. So that's part of the reason why we think that streetcars are a good investment for cities. The other reason is because, again, we see this attraction to development, just remarkable change in interest in the way that cities are growing, where more development is happening around the transit lines, and the return to the tax base is much higher when you have that public investment in transit.
You keep saying they're cheap, but how do you assess the cost?
Well, Houston did a remarkable thing in that they paid for their own light rail line to go down Main Street. And they didn't take any federal money to build that line, which is remarkable in itself. But the success that we're seeing in communities like Portland come in part because of what we were talking about earlier. They've formed real partnerships between the people who are concerned about land use and development and the people who are concerned about transportation. All of these groups work together to implement a vision. One of the challenges in a place like Houston is that because they've chosen not to regulate development in their communities, the market decides what it wants to do. And if the market doesn't recognize the value that transit provides, the development doesn't happen. So there needs to be this partnership built between transportation, land use, development, and community to really get the benefits of transit.
You've cited the success of the streetcar in Portland's Pearl District and the development that has occurred there, but I just looked at Houston's system, and while it's a really nice system, it's not had nearly the same impact on development along the line. What's the difference between those two systems, those that stimulate development and those that don't?
The market does recognize this, but if we don't set the table, it is much more difficult for the market to respond.
But aren't you arguing that the market recognizes the value of transit?
Well, what I mean is that we need to put in place the incentives and the ground rules for attracting development to these areas, to signal to the marketplace, we're ready to have you come on in. In many cases, the zoning that exists along these transit lines before this partnership is made only allows very low density development that may not even be appropriate for transit. So until we change the rules to allow the kind of places that we want to see spring up, it's very hard for the development community to respond.
By advocating streetcars, do you run the risk of becoming yet another special transportation interest group rather than a group that advocates for the best solution and a connected transportation system?
Well, you know, streetcars we spent some work on because no one else was looking at them as a real opportunity. But we work with communities all over the country on all kinds of transit. This morning I was on a call talking about how to introduce bus rapid transit into Sacramento, California, a region that already has a light rail system, is building a streetcar, and now wants to layer on additional transit options. So, yes, what we need to do in America is get to a point where people can live the car-free lifestyle if they want to. And that is dependent on having a layering of all different kinds of transport options, as well as great places that people can get to via these options.
You've observed that we are sprawling and reinvesting simultaneously. If gas prices remain at these historic highs or go even higher, do you expect sprawl to continue?
Well, I think some of the latest information is really showing that the mortgage meltdown is really hitting the sprawling communities extremely hard. And so part of that, I think, is because people are spending a significant portion of their income just on transportation expenditures. That whole notion of driving to qualify for a mortgage is beginning to break down, in part because of the stress on families that their transportation expenditures are providing. So I think the gas price issue is really going to hit those edge communities the hardest. And many people are going to begin to reexamine their choices.
You mentioned earlier that transit-oriented development creates real estate value that can be captured and then reinvested in cities. What are the ways value is captured by cities?
One of the ways is that property taxes and sales taxes rise, and so we can begin to look at those as sources of revenue for some of the great things that we want to see in neighborhoods. More people ride the transit, and so the profits that come back to the transit system rise there as well. We can capture some fees on all kinds of things like parking and business improvement fees and ticket fees are ways to begin to capture some of that value, put it back into building great neighborhoods and building transit. Many communities use a tool called tax increment financing, which says that after a certain point in time, the tax revenues, real estate revenues from this area go back specifically into this district. And then public-private partnerships to help build transit, build neighborhoods, build public spaces. These are all tools that many communities are beginning to experiment with.
We've talked briefly about Portland's Pearl District served by the streetcar. What are the most impressive examples of transit-oriented development around the nation?
Well, I think one of the most impressive places is what we call the Roslyn-Ballston Corridor, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. It's along the Orange Line, along their metro system. And about 25 years ago, they created a plan that would focus development around five metro stops. They said, we're going to keep our single-family neighborhoods as they are, and we're going to focus development around these station areas. That has attracted a tremendous amount of new growth. It's also help the assessed value of land around the stations increase about 81% in 10 years. 8% of the county's land generates about a third of the county's revenues, and it allows the county to have the lowest property tax rates in Northern Virginia, which is a great message to people. If we focus growth around transit and we protect the neighborhoods that we love, we can win financially. The other thing that I think is great about this example is that about half of residents take transit to work, and about three-quarters of those riders walk to the station. So they haven't had a real increase in traffic. They've just changed the way that people behave by thinking sensibly about how to focus growth around a huge public investment.
Shelley, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me.
Shelley Porticia is president and CEO of Reconnecting America. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
What happens when a city goes bankrupt? Not too many people know, because not too many cities have had to. But with the economy in the sour state it is, many cities are struggling to make ends meet. This has put the Northern California city of Vallejo in the spotlight. This week, Vallejo became the biggest city in California history to declare bankruptcy. According to an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, the city was forced to file for bankruptcy as public employee contracts had risen beyond control and the area's housing market was in a major slump. The city was facing a $16 million budget deficit, so Chapter 9 was seen as the best possible solution. Thousands of other cities facing similar budget woes throughout the U.S. are going to be watching Vallejo closely as it freezes its debts and tries to rebuild its diminished budget, a process that's expected to take years. Meanwhile, the gears have been turning in overdrive in the heads of transit planners in Chicago, where a federal transportation grant of more than $150 million was just awarded. All that money is going to be used to beef up the city's public transit system by building a new bus rapid transit project. The Chicago Tribune reports that city officials have unveiled plans for a series of dedicated bus lanes throughout the city, as well as transit stations where riders can prepay for tickets and board buses more quickly. As part of the funding agreement with the federal government, Chicago's bus rapid transit system must be up and running by 2010. The project is slated to start out with about 10 miles of bus-only lanes, but is expected to eventually expand out to cover more than 100 miles in the city. And finally, a coalition of environmental groups has come to an agreement with a land developer that will allow for the preservation of about 240,000 acres of land in Southern California. In exchange, the environmental groups will not oppose the developer's plans to build more than 26,000 homes on the land, which is about 60 miles north of LA. The developer also plans to build millions of square feet of office space, hotels, golf courses, and condominiums on the land. The Los Angeles Times reports that the deal over the land, known as Tejon Ranch, was long in the making. The coalition of environmental groups includes the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Sierra Club, Audubon California, the Planning Conservation League, and the Endangered Habitats League. The groups had previously threatened to oppose any plans for development on Tejon Ranch, but negotiations eventually succeeded. The 240,000 acres the agreement sets aside are home to a vast array of wildlife, including California condors, elk, deer, wild turkey, bobcats, and golden eagles. Though environmentalists are pleased that nearly 90% of the ranch land is being saved, many are concerned about the magnitude of the development the agreement allows, development that is most likely not far off. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk about justice in black and white with Dr. Scott Phillips. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. John Scherer runs the Enterprise Center in Chattanooga, where he is promoting an innovative way of getting the most out of the community's assets. John, if you're advising other universities on how to stimulate economic development and add value to their local communities, what would be on your checklist?
Well, the first thing I would say is through their planning and development, specifically their strategic planning process, that they would place major emphasis on institutional engagement and alignment of other institutions. As we know, institutional engagement occurs when exploration and innovation and creativity result in a synergy. That is, it's a value added for the university to not only use their resources, but they use other resources in the community and the region. I realize the universities across the country are strapped for cash, particularly your public institutions, but this is another way to where you make the best use of the resources that you have and leverage them, and you'll be surprised what could return.
You feel strongly about the need for communities to operate at a metro level rather than at a city or county level. That makes sense because economies are regional, but tax dollars are not. So how do you get people in alignment around that?
Yeah, well, first of all, you start at the grassroots level, and that is with the people. And the more people you have, and whatever you design should be designed by the people. And the more you involve the people, the more people are going to be included in it. And I think it spreads then from cities to counties to other cities and other counties that then constitute a metropolitan area.
Do you think people get that?
No, that's why I've spent a little time thinking about this metaphor as a means to conceptualize and communicate how city making can occur and evolve, whereby we address common interests, simultaneously meet the common good.
We often hear the lament, if only everybody would just get on the same page. You're working to make that happen in Chattanooga. Explain what you're doing.
Well, at this stage, we have a group called the Chattanooga Economic Roundtable. And this roundtable is made up of several nonprofit institutions, the Airport Authority, the university, the local community college, the Convention and Tourism Group, the African American Chamber, the regular Chamber of Commerce, and other nonprofit institutions. These people are actually, at this stage, are prioritizing needs for city making in Chattanooga. Once these needs are identified, then we look at the strategic plans of institutions in Chattanooga, and I've developed a matrix of strategic plans. And where we find a priority need and multiple institutions that say they want to address that need, this group then convenes these institutions, and this is what we call aligned institutions, from which they develop specific initiatives that they have a common interest in. The strategic plan then becomes the springboard from which interests have been invested to meet needs that will ultimately, as a result of working together, result in meeting the common good.
So you pick an issue, convene the groups that have a role to play, and then you see how each is working and where there may be overlaps or areas where they could reinforce each other?
That's correct. Oftentimes, strategic plans are people invest a lot of time and energy in them, but then ultimately they result in a nice binder placed on a bookshelf and collect dust.
This is your solution to making them actionable.
That's right. It's like the entire forest being nurtured by the soil. All institutions are nurtured by the interconnectivity and independent functions and functions and responsibilities of people that are already on board.
What do you expect to come from this, John?
Well, the best thing that can come from it is growth of quality places. It's really recognizing that city making is a continuous ongoing process, just like soil making in the forest is a continuous ongoing process. So if others can understand and buy the metaphor that actually a city is a large ecosystem, then we understand each other better and we can work collectively.
Dr. John Shearer runs the Enterprise Center in Chattanooga. Dr. Scott Phillips is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Denver. His recent research examines capital punishment in America, violent and nonviolent conflict management, and use of force during the arrest and detention of deportees. Scott, you chose to study the justice system of Harris County, Texas, Houston. Why Harris County?
Well, I lived in Houston for about 5 years, and Harris County is known to be the capital of capital punishment. The county has executed 102 people, which means that if Harris County were a state, it would rank second in executions after Texas, recently passing Virginia. And the county has also executed more people than all the other major urban counties in Texas combined. So it was a combination of living in Houston and simultaneously being interested in the county's sort of special place in capital punishment.
You found two kinds of racial disparities in Harris County. What were they?
The disparity that others have often found is that the death penalty was more likely to be imposed if the victim was white. The disparity that is less common is to find, as I did, that the death penalty was more likely to be imposed if the defendant was black.
Can you speculate about the reasons?
Well, the race of victim effect appears to be virtually universal. Researchers have found that the death penalty is more likely to be imposed if the victim is white in lots of different places, lots of different time periods. Why my findings sort of challenge conventional wisdom regarding the race of the defendant is difficult to answer. There are probably two potential answers. One is that it may just be that the race of the defendant matters in some times and places, but not others. Or it could be that the same disparities lie undetected in some prior studies that didn't control for as many other facts of the case.
Is this a reflection of racism in America?
That's possible.
Are there places where these disparities don't exist?
Well, in the research, I'm very careful to use the word disparities rather than the word discrimination, because the word discrimination implies purposeful action. And I certainly don't think the district attorney's office means for these disparities to emerge. In fact, they take steps to try to remove race from the process. But criminal justice is a microcosm of larger society, and given that race still matters in larger society, it's not all that surprising that it would creep its way into capital punishment as well.
Still, if the race of victims reflects disparities, that still matters, doesn't it?
Well, in terms of race of defendant, most studies don't find that effect. It's mostly limited to race of the victim. So I suppose in that way, the answer would be yes. I think what people have argued, and I think it's a persuasive case, is that to seek the death penalty and impose it more on behalf of whites is essentially to value the lives of whites more than other groups, that their death is somehow more worthy of the ultimate state penalty.
You believe you found a robust relationship between race and the likelihood of being sentenced to death, even after the race of the victim and other factors were held constant. But Texans have pushed back on your findings. One critic even called your findings bizarre. What are their complaints?
Their complaint seems to be that I've done some sort of statistical voodoo magic, and that's just not the case. The methods are standard social science, but I'm glad you asked that question because it's nice to have an opportunity to unpack this a little bit more. The basic percentages suggested that black defendants and white defendants were treated the same, but the more complicated statistical models suggested disparities in the treatment of black defendants. The reason that happens is because the objective data indicate that the district attorney was more likely to seek the death penalty under certain circumstances. So, for example, the district attorney was more likely to seek the death penalty if the crime was especially heinous based on the aggravating and mitigating circumstances, or the victim was killed in an especially brutal manner, such as being beaten, stabbed, or asphyxiated, or the victim was vulnerable due to being especially old or young, or the victim was raped, or the victim was kidnapped. And what turns out to be the case is that the district attorney sought the death penalty against black and white defendants at the same rate, despite the fact that the murders committed by black defendants were less likely to include all of the features I just mentioned. So the district attorney sought the death penalty at the same rate against both groups, despite the fact that those black defendants committed murders that had less of the characteristics that, according to the district attorney's behavior, make a murder especially serious.
The Supreme Court has ruled that even statistical evidence of racial disparities in the administration of the death penalty is not unconstitutional. So what impact do you expect your findings to have?
It's an interesting question. The Supreme Court ruled in McCleskey versus Kemp, which was decided in 1987, that statistical disparities alone, without evidence of discrimination against the particular defendant in the case at hand, didn't rise to the level of a constitutional violation. And it's interesting to note that the justice who wrote the opinion, Powell, later told his biographer that if he could change one decision, it would be McCleskey. But as you say, the route of challenging these disparities through the courts is essentially closed. So it will be a question of whether legislators choose to act or whether the district attorney's office chooses to act in ways that might reduce the effect of race.
Let's shift subjects a minute and talk about immigration control. You've studied this, you've written on this topic, and you've written specifically on our blunders in border control over the past couple of decades. What did you find?
Well, some colleagues and I at the University of Houston received a grant to go to El Salvador and to interview people who had been deported. And we interviewed a random sample of deportees and tried to find out from them, how were you treated by the police? And the vast majority were treated well, But there were a sizable portion that had either suffered sort of physical abuse or verbal abuse in the form of racial slurs. And when we compared that to research others had done about how American citizens are treated at the hands of the police, what we found is that people being deported seem to suffer a little bit more, which probably shouldn't be that surprising. A lot of the cases happen in the middle of nowhere. No one's watching. The people don't have much recourse, etc.
Did you make policy recommendations as a result of your work?
We did not.
Do you want to share any policy ideas with us now?
We had some ideas, and we have not publicly talked about those ideas yet, but that's still something that we're interested in.
You've also written on the impact of guns. Tough neighborhoods all over America are experiencing a new wave of gun violence. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley said in his State of the City address last week that it is his single biggest frustration. Do you have any advice to offer him and other mayors on how to stop the gun violence?
I wish there was an easy answer to that one. I think there's just not.
Well, are there any complex answers?
Well, we certainly know that countries that don't have the same level of sort of gun ownership and use as we do have lower rates of homicide. But at the same time, you know, it's also true that most gun owners don't use their guns in a harmful way. And so it's not at all clear what the answer is. And you know, the Supreme Court will soon be looking at the issue of the Second Amendment. So perhaps we'll have some more guidance on that area soon.
What does your work in Harris County say about the larger issue of race in America?
Well, I think that my research in Harris County, I think what it says is that race still matters. And that may not be a conclusion that we want to hear, but I think that that's the truth. It's been interesting to read how bloggers have reacted to the research. And one of the general themes seems to be, this just isn't true. This just can't still be a problem. This has to be somehow made up by the liberal media or by some liberal college professor. People don't seem to want to accept that race might actually still play a role in criminal justice.
If these findings came to your attention, Scott, and you were running the Harris County system of justice, what would you do? What would you change?
One of the ideas that I've talked about is an idea called desocialization, which was a concept advanced by a sociologist named Donald Black from the University of Virginia. And Black basically argues that there's sort of a powerful simplicity that race can't affect decisions if the race of the parties is unknown. So let me just speak for a moment about how that might be done in Harris County. Prosecutors within the district attorney's office prepare what's called the Capital Murder Summary Memorandum. And that memorandum describes the case, and the district attorney uses it to decide whether to seek the death penalty. And the district attorney's office, in response to my research, has said that memorandum doesn't include the race of the parties. We already have done something to address this potential problem. And I think that's a fantastic first step, but it could be taken much further. As the system currently stands, there are lots of ways that race could sort of seep into the process. The district attorney could look at the names of the parties and get some clue as to race, or the location of the crime, or the pictures of the people, if it includes pictures. So one way to perhaps address the problem would be to take the step that the district attorney's office has already implemented and expand it. And for example, hire an assistant within the office who would strip this memorandum of all potential hints of race, and ask that the prosecutors who prepare the memo and might know the race of the parties don't make a recommendation as to whether to pursue death. And finally, I think you'd have to sequester the district attorney from coverage in the media of pending cases where the race might be revealed. And although that might seem extreme, it's exactly what we ask of jurors.
And I assume these are changes you would make if you were running the Harris County justice system.
Well, there are clearly other things you could do. I mean, abolishing capital punishment would also eliminate racial disparities, but that's probably not realistic in Texas at the moment. And whether that's advisable or not is not a question that I can answer as a social scientist. Another step would be for the district attorney's office to conduct their own research, because they don't seem to be persuaded by the research I've done. And so perhaps it's time for them to choose a group of independent experts to do the research again, to duplicate what I've done. And I would suggest if they do so, they should choose people who've never done research on race and capital punishment in Texas, people that are completely independent, have not reached any prior conclusions, and let the chips fall where they may.
Do your findings have anything to say to individual jurors who are deliberating on a single case?
You know, jurors are an interesting part of this process for a couple of reasons. One is that the research showed that the district attorney was more likely to pursue death if the defendant was black or the victim was white. But actually, the disparities in the district attorney's decision to pursue death were partially reversed by juries, which I argue in the research is presumably because every once in a while the district attorney is overreaching and the jurors are providing a correction. So in my research, at least, the jurors are reversing some of these racial disparities. Now, the racial disparities still remain, but they're not as big as they are in the prior stage of the case where the district attorney is deciding whether to seek death. The other thing that's fascinating about jurors is we think of jurors as the quintessential moment within a case. And I'm not sure that's exactly true. I mean, in my research, for example, there were 504 defendants who were indicted for capital murder. The district attorney sought the death penalty against 129 of those 504. Out of the 129, a death sentence was returned in 98 cases. So once the district attorney decides who to go after, the die is essentially cast, because the district attorney is highly selective, but highly effective. He didn't go after the death penalty nearly as often as he could have, but once he went for it, he almost always got it. So jurors partially reverse the disparities, but the die is largely cast.
Scott, what's your next project?
Well, the next project, there are several more papers that I want to write from the data that I've collected in Harris County. One, for example, is going to look at, does it matter whether you have the resources to hire an attorney to represent you if you're a defendant? Another project is to go beyond the original data and use trial transcripts to investigate the cases at an even deeper level of sort of specificity.
What do you expect these inquiries to tell you?
Well, the research on the legal counsel, which is still ongoing, so I don't want to say too much, but it does seem to matter quite a bit if you can pool together the resources to hire someone to represent you.
I've always wondered about the inequities in the justice system, depending on which attorney you hire and his or her relationship with the prosecutor. Is that another form of potential inequity in the system? Or does that make a difference? How can you best assure that you're going to be treated fairly? I don't know. Take one of those and figure out what the second part of that question was. So, you're listening to...
I do. I mean, people have argued for many, many years that capital punishment is imposed in what people say is an arbitrary way. And what they mean by that, let me give an example, is if you were to take 100 files and you were to take out the piece of paper that says whether the person got the death penalty, and you were to give those files over to people, and all the files had in them were the legal facts of the case, the argument is you couldn't recreate who got the death penalty and who didn't. You couldn't recreate it without also knowing the social facts. Was the person white? Was the person black? Did the person have the resources to hire an attorney? Did the person kill a female victim or a male victim? Did the person kill a white victim or a black victim? And so the idea of arbitrariness is, using the legal facts alone, it's almost impossible to recreate the outcomes without knowing those social facts that have such a profound influence.
Scott, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me on.
Scott Phillips is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Denver. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Happiness is on Walker Smith's mind this week. Our City Views commentator discovers that, scientifically speaking, he's getting better with age.
Happiness is a U-shaped curve, at least as far as age is concerned. Scientists who study the correlates of our sense of well-being have found that overall happiness with our lives declines as we move into middle age, then rebounds once we get past our 40s. In other words, the midlife crisis is not a figment of our imaginations. It is a real thing that can be plotted as a U-shaped curve. I remember myself in my 30s and 40s as a crazed, work-obsessed, stressed-out person. Nothing was good enough. Nothing was fast enough. Nothing I did, earned, or achieved was enough. I was chasing my tail in pursuit of elusive goals while ignoring the satisfactions, big and small, all around me. Mine is a typical story. As we move past our 40s, we learn better how to temper our expectations and cope with the stresses and demands in our lives. We come to accept, even enjoy, our position in life and the possibilities and limitations associated with it. We also have more experience dealing with the annoyances, discourtesies, and disappointments that are an unavoidable part of life. We know what's coming, so we are ready for it and we know what to do. Our sense of control over work and life grows as we move past midlife. There may even be something physiological going on here too. A decline in testosterone levels and a diminishing neurological desire to seek excitement and stimulation account for some of our growing sense of ease and contentment once we move past midlife. We seem to be programmed to consolidate our victories and not put anything more at risk. Life becomes a matter of being rather than a quest for getting, and we become happier as a result. But this slackening of competitive fire does not signal the beginning of a decline. In fact, healthy, fit, and active people in their 70s are just as happy as people in their 20s. Life has no less to offer just because we begin to accept it for what it is. The secret is to stay engaged, albeit with new focus and more realistic ambition. What has surprised researchers most about the U-shaped curve of happiness is that our personalities are not immutable and set in stone once we reach our 30s. It turns out that you can teach an old dog new tricks, and that old dog can learn to be more at ease and less anxious. Indeed, not only do our personalities change as we move through midlife, the process of personality change accelerates. In the space of just a few years, we develop a new identity and a new way of interacting with the world and others around us. This is an opportunity not to be ignored. Whatever we have been before, as we mature, we have the chance to become better and to reorient the ways in which we affect things. No longer driven by a need for more, we can allow ourselves the freedom to live with less by giving more to others, and thereby becoming more at peace with ourselves. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.